Oman sits on the eastern side of the Arabian Peninsula, wedged between Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and the United Arab Emirates, and it's just a brief trip by boat from Iran. Despite its strategic location, diplomatic ties, and oil wealth, we generally don't hear much about the Sultanate and even less about political dissatisfaction there. We're joined now by Joe Stork, Deputy Director of the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. Welcome to today's Backstory segment, Joe.
Glad to be with you.
Is there much political dissatisfaction in Oman?
Well, Oman is one of those places like Saudi Arabia, like the UAE, where two things. I mean, one is there's a lot more going on than most people are aware of. There is stuff going on. But number two, it's very hard to know exactly what is going on. Governance is rather opaque. It's a place where there are lots of red lines, so people tend not to raise their heads and raise their voices because they expect, negative consequences if they do. So I think that's part of the reason why we haven't seen more than more going on there. But I would point out that there have been some pretty, I mean, for certainly by Omani standards, some pretty serious demonstrations have gone on there this year.
And were the protests similar to the ones elsewhere in the region? Were they economic or sectarian?
They weren't sectarian, and I'm not sure what you're referring to.
In Bahrain, for example, we have Shiite majority and a Sunni leader.
Yeah, but the demonstrations there were not sectarian. I mean, the government in Bahrain has done all it can to, put them in a sectarian mold and exacerbate the communal tensions that exist there. But no, the protests in Bahrain were very much not sectarian. They were very much around political demands for greater openness, greater democracy, and so forth. Now, in Oman, though, to come to your question, in Oman, the protests were much more economic, about economic issues. You had right after the fall of Mubarak in Egypt in sort of mid-February, you saw a sit-in in Muscat in the capital. It was pretty small scale. I'd say those were political demands. That was sort of local intelligentsia, a small handful of activists. The sit-in went on for a number of weeks, but it never, achieved any kind of a critical mass. It was not a focus of repression, at least not until other things started to happen elsewhere in the country that were much more fueled, I think, by economic demands.
How does the Qaboos regime measure up to the region's other autocrats, the Assads, the House of Saud, Saleh, in terms of its human rights record?
It's a place where it's very much in character, shall we say, with the region, with the Arabian Peninsula in particular. I would say Yemen is sort of a case by itself. Oman is very much like the other GCC, Gulf Cooperation Council states, in that it's a hereditary monarch, Qaboos. He basically takes all the decisions. There's a consultative council of, 70 or 80 people that is elected but is only advisory, and even the people who are elected to that council are, pretty well vetted before they can stand. So it's in no sense a freewheeling political environment there.
Well, how long has the Sultan Qaboos been Oman's leader?
He has been there since, I think it was 1970. 71, so it's 40 years now, 41 years.
He deposed his father, didn't he?
He deposed his father. He did. And his father was like some other similar autocrats in the region, was, among other things, extremely what would this word be? I mean, paranoid of any kind, any intrusions of modernity. I mean, there were two or three schools in the whole country. There were hardly any roads. I mean, it was a terribly isolated place under sort of British political and military protection. It finally got to be too much. There were revolutions happening elsewhere in the region, in Yemen in particular. There was revolts that were starting in Oman, particularly in that western province that abuts what was then southern Yemen. So things were starting to happen, and Qaboos's coup was very much a prophylactic one, one designed to prevent things from getting worse. And he did, you know, it has to be said, he certainly did a lot to modernize the country in terms of schools, health care, just basic amenities, basic needs, meeting basic needs, but politically remaining very much an autocratic, a dictatorship.
Well, last year, Nicholas Kristof wrote in the New York Times also that not only was Oman one of the most hidebound societies of the world 40 years ago, there was no television, radios were banned as the work of the devil, and there were no Omani diplomats abroad.
Yeah, no, it was a terribly isolationist place. Yemen had been like that before the revolution there in 1962. But Oman was kind of the last holdout in that respect. I mean, even the Saudis, for all of their, the very, very, very closed nature of that society, Oman went the one better on that score.
Do women enjoy more political freedom relative to Oman's neighbors?
I would put it this way. Omanis don't enjoy too much more political freedom, do not enjoy any more political freedom. That goes for men and women. There are a few women who are in this actually, they're not in the elected consultative council. They're in an appointed state council, again, of about 70 or so people that's appointed by Qaboos. There are several women in that body. There are several women, I believe, in the 32-member cabinet. I actually don't know if the reason they're not in the consultative council is because none were allowed to stand for election. Perhaps none wished to stand for election. I'm not really sure, but it's not like Saudi Arabia. It's not a question of women not being able to drive or women go to schools. It doesn't, as far as I'm aware, there's not the same kind of gender segregation that you've got going on in Saudi Arabia.
Does can Sultan Qaboos bin Said be described as pro-Western?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Yep. No, very, very close strategic ties with the West, with the United States, with the UK.
But it also maintains good relations with some of its neighbors who are less friendly.
Less friendly to the West, you
mean?
Well, yeah, because that's the neighborhood he lives in. So I think he's pretty well advised to maintain that kind
how
of
significant,
those relationships.
How significant is the fact that Oman never joined OPEC?
Oman is not a major oil producer, so it hasn't. It's not like some other states, perhaps, that didn't join OPEC, such as Norway, for instance, where they, it left them greater leeway to, in terms of their production rates of production and so forth, influencing the market and so forth. I don't actually know the answer to that question, why they didn't join, but in a sense, it's kind of been a question I haven't thought of because they're just not a force at all on the, amongst the oil producers.
I'm speaking to Joe Stork, Deputy Director, Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. We're talking about Oman. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, getting all choked up talking about Oman. More than half of Oman's 2.8 million people are under the age of 20, and 83% are under 35. Are its demographics similar to other nations in the region?
Very much so. Very much so. I mean, that's the pattern you're seeing
throughout that region. Why so many young people?
Why so many young people? Well, I think it's a combination of factors. One thing, improved health, access to health care throughout the region means that more children, more babies survive to become children and then become young adults and so forth. So you've had population growth again, very much like what you've seen elsewhere in the region. I don't think there's any particular explanation for Oman. It fits the pattern.
Well, the ruler is pro-Western. What about the population? Is there anti-U.S. sentiment there as there is throughout so much of the region?
We don't know because Oman remains a pretty closed society. There's no significant the press is pretty watches its tongue, shall we say? I mean, it's against the law to criticize the Sultan and other high officials, so not much of that goes on. Criticizing policy decisions, whether it's foreign policy or domestic policy, there are red lines there that the Omani media haven't exceeded. There's no consultative council, as I indicated, is one that's highly vetted, so it's not a place where these kinds of issues get raised. So what I can say is we're not aware that there's any significant anti-Western sentiment in Oman, but then there's a lot we don't know about political attitudes in Oman.
Well, I'd imagine there are strong feelings about the British one way or another. They played a major role in Oman in the decade after Sultan Qaboos's coup. I've read that British officers commanded all branches of Oman's armed forces, and hundreds more were on loan to the Sultanate.
That's right. But we just don't know enough about the sort of political attitudes in Oman. I think it's probably fair to say that there's a much greater familiarity with the British than with the Americans, although I think that's changed over the last decade or so. I think we've seen a lot more U.S. Military activity and basing activity and so forth in Oman than previously.
Do people have access to Al Jazeera?
They do. They have access. Well, generally speaking, they have access to outside, satellite networks, for instance, including Al Jazeera. So yes, and that's certainly had some impact on political attitudes. But again, Omanis don't really have the space to voice their opinions on these kinds of things.
Well, how rich is this country? Following the protests earlier this year, Sultan Qaboos gave orders to create 50,000 jobs, and he also offered to pay $386 a month to every job seeker. Has that happened? Will these reforms calm the unrest, do you think?
Because we don't. I don't know if that's happened yet. He did make those promises. The unrest, I don't know if it's going to. I mean, what's sort of ended the unrest is, was a pretty serious crackdown by security forces and army. To what extent there's been delivery on these promises, and that's helped, I just can't say.
Well, we've seen similar things elsewhere. Promises made in Jordan, in Syria, reshufflings of cabinets.
Right.
What is your sense? Is this a place a time bomb? Is it going to explode again somewhere the line?
No. Well, I don't think it's somewhere in between. It's not a time bomb, or at least I don't see any evidence of that.
No spillover from Yemen, its neighbor?
There's no sign of that either. Yemen is a country with 16 or 17? At least 20 million people. Oman is a country of 3 million people, 3.5 million people, of whom a million are foreign workers, expats. So the dynamics are much different on that from Yemen. In that respect, it doesn't have the same kind of communal sectarian divisions that Bahrain has. Another small population country that has seen a great deal of unrest. So it's there are factors that have helped immunize Oman, I think, from the kind of unrest. You have, as I say, we have seen unrest. We've seen large demonstrations there. We've seen the army come in. We've seen deaths of protesters and so forth. We've got a situation where there are, between 30 and 40 people on trial for, being ringleaders of the demonstrations and so forth. So to what extent has have the economic incentives and the economic promises of the Sultan contributed to the quiet we've seen since roughly since the middle of May? So we're not talking about a long time here. We're talking about somewhere between 4 and 6 weeks since we saw some pretty serious disturbances.
Joe Stork is Deputy Director of Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. Thank you so much for talking with us today about Oman.
Sure. Thanks for calling.